Yeah, that's right. So, hello everybody. So the title of my talk is Swirls, Fingers, and Directed Bulk Motility in Spreading Epithelial Sheets. And it's a theoretical work that I've been doing with my friends from my time in Paris, Jens Elgeti, who's right here, and Edouard Hanesso, and also with Wouter Jean-Rappel and Herbie Levine at UC San Diego, which is where I'm currently postdoc. So, since it's a theoretical work, I should spend some time actually introducing the experimental system which we're actually treating. And I'm going to spend quite a bit of time. But some of you who have been here for the entire conference have heard a lot about it already. For example, in Pascal Zilberzin's talk, or also by Boris Schreimann. And so the system we're looking at are essentially a monolayered epithelial tissues growing on a substrate. So these type of experiments, I took them out of a paper by Pascal Zilberzin, where they actually just seeded these cells on a substrate separated by agarose blocks. And then by removing these agarose blocks, you can create these holes in the tissue. And after they remove them, you see the stripes actually spreading and closing the tissue and going back to confluence. And this is kind of a experimental model system for re-epithelialization, which is a phase in wound healing. And
they'll grow over the agarose blocks.
They don't seem to grow over the agarose blocks, right? And I mean, there's many ways of doing this. The initial way was just doing a laser ablation, right? Just killing them with a laser and making a hole like that. But what they see most often is kind of the same thing, which is that at the edge of these stripes, they see these finger-like protrusions, for example. And Pascal was talking a lot about, you know, these type of things. And usually at the tip of these fingers, there's one cell that's morphologically kind of different, that has a kind of a very pronounced lamellipodium, and it's usually quite a bit bigger than the rest. And so this is a plot of the velocity field in the tissue, and you see that really the fingers are kind of going off at a faster speed, and there's some large-scale velocity fields arising in the tissue. So another aspect of this system is that done by the group of Dave Weitz, and also Edouard did some part of this work, is where they actually look these same cells and they see them at below confluence and watch them grow and form a confluent tissue and then undergo this transition to kind of a much higher density where they kind of settle down and become different. And but when you see them below confluence and they start merging, what happens is that you see these large-scale flow patterns actually occurring in the tissue.
What are these cells? Are they fibroblasts?
Well, it's these MKD canine kidney cells. Essentially, this more or less supposed to be the same system that Boris Schreimann uses and Pascal Zilberzin. It's always the same cells. So it's essentially epithelial cells, but when they're isolated, right, they go undergo this transition, right? Since they don't have contact with their neighbors, they're not contact inhibited, and they get this kind of fibroblast-like phenotype. And apparently, even when they're touching each other, it takes them a while to settle down and for contact inhibition really to kick in. But I'm going to talk a lot more about that actually later on as I go on.
You just had one stripe rather than a whole sequence. You said one stripe of epithelial cells, would it, and then you took away the agarose blocks, would it finger out? Or do you need another stripe to be?
No, I think it's pretty generic, like any kind of surface. Of these cells that are spreading, you will have these fingers. The only difference is, I think, is that if it's already moving and if the whole thing is kind of already in a steady state of expansion, then I think the fingers are less pronounced. But that's maybe also just my interpretation talking here. But there'll be a lot more about this kind
of thing. So I guess I'm asking, why does he need a whole series of...
That's what he did in this experiment, but I think he has other experiments where he just uses single agarose blocks. Now he has circular disc-shaped holes in the tissue, and he looks at the fingering there. But so essentially, my main point was just that one observation is that you have these fingering protrusions at the edge, and it's one of the things that we're looking at explaining.
There's not an interaction between this.
Right, exactly. Is it signaling or is it just diffusion?
It's not.
Well, basically, that's kind of the origin of this work, that we're doing some speculation on where these kind of things could come from. But maybe hold on for a few minutes, and we can discuss later on, right? So essentially this group, Dave Weitz, they really did a quantitative analysis of these of this data, right? Of these swirl-like patterns that occur in the bulk. Now we're back in the bulk. And what they find is that the typical size of these swirls actually increases as the cell density goes up. Because remember, the cells here are dividing, so slowly they're going to higher and higher density. And as that happens, the typical size of the swirls goes up, and the typical velocity of them goes down. That's just another observation that I want to point out. And now, the third type of phenomenon that I want to introduce before I get to the actual heart of the talk is the experiments done by Crépin et al., also around the Weitz, which is essentially the same group of people who have been done these experiments. So what they did was they actually were the first group to do traction force microscopy on entire colonies of these of cells spreading. So essentially, traction force microscopy, they have just beads submerged in the gel on which these cells are growing, and then from the deformation field of these beads, they're able to solve the inverse problem and actually get a detailed map of the individual forces, the traction forces exerted by the tissue on the substrate. And there's several surprising things that came out of this paper. So one of the first things that's kind of striking is that cells kind of deep in the bulk of the tissue actually exert some motility forces, where originally it was thought that it's actually only the cells at the edge that are doing all the pulling and are the only ones that really don't have contact inhibition. But so experimental groups have actually detected cryptic lamellipodia hidden underneath the neighboring cells that are doing these type of that are creating these type of stresses. And I should explain, in this plot here, it's essentially just the x component of the traction force, so the component perpendicular to the edge. So red means that they're actually pulling toward the edge, blue means that they're pulling in the other direction, or at least that the traction force is in the other direction. And so they did quite a bit more than that, right? So here's the same picture for the entire, for a slice of the entire colony. And you see that this pattern persists very far into the middle of the colony. And it's highly discontinuous, but surprisingly what they found was when they just averaged a certain distance away from the edge of the colony, what they found is that actually there's a bias. So a certain distance away from the edge, if you average the x component, which is the full dots here of the traction force, you get a non-zero force. And so whereas for the parallel component, it averaged out to zero and stays zero all the way to the center of the tissue. But for the perpendicular component, it starts off higher at the edge and then drops down, but then it goes to a constant. And essentially, it stays at this constant all the way throughout the colony. And actually, in one dimension, it's possible to just integrate these traction forces. So force balance condition in one dimension, you can just integrate it and actually get the stress tensor in the sheet from these traction forces. And this is what they did here. And the next plot shows actually the stress field that they determine in this way over the entire colony. And it's quite surprising because it shows that the cells at the edge actually only making a small contribution to the entire tension that's in the sheet, and that most of the tension actually arises in this linear part, kind of constant traction force part, all the way to the center of the colony, where then it has to flatten out just by symmetry reasons. And so the tension that they reach is, at least determined in this manner, is pretty impressively high. And even more strangely, when you look at this plot, the cell density is actually highest in the center, where the tension is also highest. So and that they actually investigated in more detail in their in their supplementary material. So here they look at the cell density as a distance from the leading edge as a function of time. And you see that essentially everywhere within the tissue, cell density is increasing, because of course this part here kind of corresponds to more this location here. And here's a snapshot. I don't know exactly what the scale is. It might be 100 micron, but it's the same scale for two. One of them is at the edge, and one of them is in the center. So those are the kind of observations I just wanted to point out before getting started, and those are the kind of things that we're aiming at understanding. And so just to summarize quickly, so the kind of questions we want to know is, So could there be maybe one mechanism behind all of these different phenomena that I just showed, like fingering, swirls, and this motility coordination? You know, how do the cells in the bulk actually know where the boundary is? Right? How does this bias arise? And can the mechanical properties of these spreading colonies actually be understood just from some kind of simple model? Like, why are they under tension and still at high density? And finally, you know, what's the advantage of actually going through kind of some sophisticated coordination of motility like that? And why should the cells bother, right? And can we quantify that? So now I also have to quickly review the things that have been said in the literature on the subject and stuff people have proposed. Of course, one can always talk about biochemical signaling. Maybe the cells at the edge just produce some kind of signal that diffuses throughout the colony and creates this gradient that makes the cell polarize. Other things that have been proposed is interactions with the neighboring cells. Like, for example, Nirgov proposed that since the cell has some kind of motility force in the lamellipodium, this is kind of a polarization. So perhaps, and since this lamellipodium is hidden below the neighboring cell, this kind of could lead to kind of a local elastic interaction and could give you a tendency of lamellipodia to align. So you have this kind of planar elasticity interaction, which could give you this long-range alignment. In a similar model was done by Wolgemuth and others, and they added some additional effect that perhaps the polarization is influenced by a torque by inhomogeneities in the flow. So like if you take a rod and you submerge it in a fluid and you have different flow velocities, right, it'll turn and realign, right? So they put this kind of mechanism in there as well. Then in the follow-up paper, Tripas and others have suggested that it might be the principal axis of the stress tensor that gives you the some kind of orientation. And then Jens, just playing devil's advocate, suggested that maybe it's the gradient of pressure, right? So we're also trying to come up with other alternatives to what we're going to suggest. So, but all of these kind of models have some drawbacks. Like, for example, I'm not clear, I don't really understand how the principal axis of the stress tensor, that just gives you an axis, not really a direction. And the gradient of pressure also has some problems, right? It seems to work well when a cell starts exerting tension, the tension starts building up, because it always goes in the direction of down the gradient of pressure, or up the gradient of pressure. So, but on the other hand, if it pushes and you have a compressive movement of cells, it'll just create a compressive force and it'll continue moving in that direction. So in other words, you pull on the cell and it always does the opposite of what you do, and it's kind of an unstable mechanism, and also for swirls and stuff like that, it's not easy to understand how it could work. So, but our suggestion, the kind of idea that we're going to pursue, or that I'm going to present to you in this talk, is essentially just interaction with the substrate. So we're just going to say motility forces just have the tendency to align with velocities. And that's essentially just saying that it's maybe you can understand this kind of stuff just as a flock in terms of flocking theory. So, and models like that have been made by Toner and Sriram Ramaswamy, where you just give the cell a spontaneous velocity and then investigate the properties. And of course, we're going to make a lot of simplifications. We're going to assume that, you know, the cells are all the same. You know, cells at the edge are the same as cells in the bulk, which of course is not true. But we'll just take the approach. We'll go with this idea and see how far we can get. But so just to make clear, yeah, sorry.
Just to understand, so the reasoning behind the coordinating motilities, I mean, the reason why you claim that there is this coordinating motility on large scale is that your x component of the velocity doesn't go to zero but stays constant.
Of the traction force.
Of the traction force.
Right? So somehow the cells are nowhere the edges. They just have a bias to pull towards the edge.
But that distance, it has to depend on your width of the colony, does it?
Well, one fear I have is that maybe there's something wrong with this Tripas paper, but so far there hasn't been many papers reproducing this result, but I only have this one paper that where they show this, so I don't really know how it depends on different sizes of colonies, right?
Okay. Because in the center it has to be zero, right?
I mean just by the fact that the stress in the end the force has to be zero on the colony, right? And the stress has to go back to zero at the other side of the tissue.
So I would guess that some biochemical signaling, there would be some length scale and
So one finite length scale
independent of the size of the
So for sure these colonies are pretty huge. They're like tens of thousands of cells, right? So as big a colony as people grow in the lab, and they they're still under tension. So now to get back to the mechanism, yeah?
Simple question. These are sitting on a nutrient substrate, right, in the experiment. What are they sitting on?
They're sitting on a substrate, like an elastic substrate, but I think the nutrients actually come from the top.
Okay.
So I think it's made more or less just an elastic that they adhere to with integrins .
Did they measure a cell division rate at the boundary compared to the inside? Is there a difference in the cell division rate at the boundary?
So cell division rate, yeah, I mean, so they essentially see cells dividing pretty much everywhere, as far as I remember. But of course, then it's not always so, 'cause some groups will report that cells only divide at the edge, and some groups will report that cells are kind of dividing everywhere. But I'm going to actually talk about that later on, because it might depend a lot on, for example, just initial conditions. Whether you start a tissue with agarose blocks that you remove, where all the cells have been sitting there for a week and are totally in their conjugate inhibited state, or you do what Klepa has done and you grow it kind of in a steady state, where it's a colony constantly expanding, it might be very different. But as far as I know, I think they're more or less dividing everywhere in the colony. So the basic idea is just maybe the cells in the tissue just behave just like us in the crowd, just to get back to motivate the picture that everybody understands. Right? So take a crowd like that, and then imagine like you had some aliens doing like a laser ablation in the crowd, and now imagine you're one of the people in the crowd, and you're actually blindfolded. Nevertheless, a group of people would be very efficient at closing this hole, right? Because essentially you just make a step in one direction, and if you bump into your neighbor, it's most likely that you'll switch directions. On the other hand, if your neighbor's actually moving, and you actually make progress in one direction, you just continue walking in that direction. So that's essentially the flocking approach to wound healing. And I have absolutely no experimental evidence for this kind of phenomenon at this point, right? So I'm just going to try to motivate a little bit that maybe actually there is this coupling between velocity and forces, right? So the one thing that everybody knows about is that these lamellipodia are incredibly sensitive to like gradients and friction and traction forces, like haptotaxis and also the elasticity of the substrate, right? So maybe even a small force changing the direction is able to destabilize the lamellipodium and change the direction. And then another just indication is a movie that Pascal Silverzahn showed, where they have one of those fingers and they cut it away with a laser from the rest of the finger. And then they get the following film. So it moves on a little bit, and then suddenly you have another lamellipodium popping up. And the direction changes, and this kind of sets the whole thing out of balance, and it just doesn't manage to go anywhere, and finally, actually, the rest of the tissue is able to catch up with it, and it stops. So, I mean, there's no proof, but I'm just arguing that it could be possible that the lamellipodium of the cell wants to be aligned in the direction where it's moving, and a lamellipodium pushing that way, but the flow of the tissue going that way might just not be very stable.
But this looks like many cells here, right?
Yeah, it's a group of cells, yeah.
So are they getting there by moving or by dividing? I mean, because it seemed like...
Oh, in the back. Dividing. Well, that's also kind of the question. I mean, I guess most of the forces are actually active motility, right? But somehow that's actually very interesting. A single cell doesn't move very far, but then when it's in a tissue and you have a whole group of cells behind you, then suddenly you're able to make kind of a very long-range, persistent walk, right? So that's, I mean, also kind of what we're interested in. But I'm saying, you know, maybe some, I mean, you could use this movie just the same, say that it's not the kind of model that we're thinking of, right? But yeah.
Mm-hmm. How do you define the velocity of the cell?
Well, I think in those experiments, they essentially tracked vertices in the of the interfaces of the cells, just because it's hard to track individual cells. But that's, I think, how they did it. But I really mean the velocity of the center, like in theoretical language, I just mean the velocity of the actual cell, like the nucleus of the cell.
Nucleus?
Yeah, just the...
Not the average. Because in this case, for me, it's quite clear that the lamin equilibrium will be in the direction of the velocity.
Yeah, so one way this could work is just that the lamellar podium tends to be on the opposite side of the nucleus. So for example, you have the velocities like this, maybe the nucleus is somehow anchored, nucleus ends up in the back, and if it's not the right direction, then you'll have something destabilizing it. So for example, a cell pulls in the wrong direction, and then then the motion will be in the other way, and you'll shift the position of the nucleus. And that could just get rid of the lamellar podium.
Your statement about the nucleus, it seems that as if the nucleus was really the center and what is imposing the direction, what is important for the direction of the cell.
It may very well be. But still the question arises, just how does the cell know then finally at the end of the day where the boundary is, right? What is the mechanism for this alignment? And so maybe it's just the fact that, yeah, they're moving, all the nuclei end up on one side of the cell, and then you have the corresponding polarization of the, but that would be kind of in agreement with what we're thinking, that there's some kind of coupling between just velocity over the substrate and the orientation of the lamellar podium. Okay, so I'll cut to the chase now, I think. So what we're doing is, we're using this particle-based simulation that Jens already talked about a lot. So essentially, each cell consists of two spheres that have a tendency to repulse each other, and if they reach a certain size checkpoint, they actually divide. And we've been applying it to three-dimensional tissues in the past, and now we made a kind of a two-dimensional version of the simulation. And here's one of the first kind of pretty bad simulations that we made, where it's just very rough parameters, and we just have random motility forces, so no coupling at all. And on the other hand, coupling of the motility force, so it just depends on the scalar product of velocity and the motility force. And we just have a rate that just increases the less aligned they are. And so what you see is that without a motility force, the tissue is very inefficient in closing the wound. Because in this case, I should also say, we turned off cell division in this case. So each cell has a tendency to expand, but they actually cannot divide. And what happens here is just that the cells at the edge are able to expand, but then after a while, the cells in the bulk have to expand, and they have to push all these layers of cells in front of them over the substrate, and that just balances the expansion pressure, and that's why it can only move very briefly. But that was just one of the first things we tried, and so the idea is going to be that this actually helps to close the wounds faster if everybody moves in that direction. And we made a kind of a more sophisticated model, just still pretty minimalistic, but we tried to really put all of those things together, right? Get tension, get swirls, get the fingering. And so the model we finally ended up using, it looks like this. So each state essentially has a non-motile state and a motile state. And there's a fixed rate at which it transitions to wake up and actually exert a motility force of a constant magnitude in a random direction. But then, depending on the orientation of the motility force, the rates are different at which they fall back asleep. So if there's actually some kind of alignment between velocity and motility force, the rate is very small, and this is a quite very stable state. Whereas if there is no alignment or anti-alignment, actually, the cells actually have much higher rate and they fall asleep. So the ratio of these rates actually is the degree of coupling between velocity and motility in our model. And of course, you can put some kind of threshold in there, how big this component has to be, but for simplicity, we just set it to zero. So when it's zero, we actually do the crossover between these two states, and we use this rate or that rate.
But the rates are the rate of A, is the rate going backwards? Or?
Yeah, that's right. So just, for example, the cell puts a lamellar podium in this direction. So now, at some rate, it'll just pick another direction. Or just, in this model, it always has to go back to sleep and then wake up again. So it'll just, the whole podium will destabilize and then maybe pick another direction.
So the cells go to sleep and wake up?
Yeah. So some cells, it just means some cells don't exert an active motility force.
The motility force is produced from the neural podium?
Yeah. So just not all cells need to have, I mean, that's what we think. I mean, that's also kind of, to some extent, speculation, right?
I'm just trying to get in your model, itself.
You're starting, sorry?
I was just trying to understand what is the ingredients in your model.
Sure, yeah. But I mean, but basically we're just saying the cell exerts a motility force of a constant magnitude in a random direction, and then depending on its alignment with the velocity, it goes back to the state from which it picks a new, a new alignment direction.
This is the velocity of the cell?
This is the velocity of the cell, yeah.
So if the force is moving, why is the velocity different?
Because it's in a tissue, right? So you can be stuck. You have a lot of neighbors, right?
Okay.
And so you get dragged by your neighbors, and so this is just, the whatever, for a single cell, it might be, it's going to be directly aligned, but then still you're going to have this rate of falling back asleep. So if this rate is very big, you're not going to move very far. Maybe you're just going to move a single cell diameter, you're going to fall back asleep, and you're going to pick another direction.
But K plus and K minus are both falling asleep, right?
Yeah.
But there's some difference between them?
Yeah, there's a difference. Like, this rate is very high, because if it's not aligned, if you're walking this way, but you're getting pulled that way, you just have a high tendency to realign, reorient yourself.
And there's some linkage between the cells or some coupling?
That we'll put in, right? That's in the in this model that Jens was talking about, where you actually have expansion, you have cell division, you have adhesive potential, you have friction between the cells, like hydrodynamic friction. So it's essentially like this dissipative particle dynamics tissue simulation. But I guess Jens actually had a whole talk about this, but probably the crowd changed kind of a lot in the meanwhile, so maybe I should have put more details in there. But so this is the kind of thing we apply. And we put it in this simulation, and just to remind you again, the situation we're trying to describe is a movie from Boris Schreimann's group, where they just watched the colony expanding, and this is essentially similar to what Trepa has shown, to what Trepa was investigating, and then I'll show you our simulation of this kind of situation.
These are real cells.
These are real cells, right? And then now this is our simulation, and we start out with a small square seed with some cells, and you can start with one cell. It doesn't make a huge difference, and you get something that looks like this. And I'm going to continue investigating this situation now. So it expands kind of in a disc-shaped manner, and then at some rate you have some holes popping up in the middle. But actually, so maybe we overdid it a little bit with the tension, because we kind of got obsessed with tension in the meanwhile. But if you look back at this movie, actually, you see the same thing is actually happening in the real tissue. You have some some holes popping up and then closing again. Look, for example, here's a hole. And there's actually a whole bunch of them. I just need to find them. And anyway, it just depends on parameters, right? So you can totally make a tissue that doesn't make a hole. But just, we picked this one because it has a really good tension profile, and which I'm going to talk about now. So what we do is we do the same thing that Trepa was doing, right? So we take this model, we simulate it, and then in here we plot the traction forces, right? So the vectors in here, I'm going to zoom in a second, are just the actual traction forces felt by the substrate, and the color code is the Y component of this traction force. So when you zoom in, you know, this is what it looks like. So you have a coarse grain patch of the substrate, and if the vector is pushing in positive Y direction, you have a red spot. And otherwise, it's blue. And you see that overall, there is a lot of noise, but over the entire colony, you have this kind of same kind of effect that Trepa was seeing. And if you look at the actual direction of the traction forces, and you remember that I said it's actually the actual force felt by the substrate, so motility force minus the friction force. You see that in this case, the tissue is moving outward, and the traction forces are pointing inward. So it means that you can already tell from that tension is going to dominate, and the tissue is going to be under tension.
I'm sorry, I'm just confused about the basic model. So how does talking to each other? They're talking sort of through the substrate, or they're talking to each other separately?
Yeah, so they feel each other, right? So it's this, they have volume exclusion, they adhere to each other. There's some friction between them when they move toward each other, right? So some hydrodynamic friction within the tissue. And in addition to that, there's a friction with the substrate. So I really, that was not good. I didn't spend enough time actually introducing the simulation. So there's cell division going on as well, and that's how it expands. And so depending on how big you make cell division, right, you will have these holes popping up or not. But then at some size, always cell division will catch up because it's exponential, right? And the moving front is kind of more given by the motility force. So so now we actually do the same thing as what is done in TREPA. We just integrate over these traction forces over the entire thickness of the colony, and we get this kind of plot. So this is time here, and this is the y component, and then here this is the pressure field. So blue means tension. So you see it starts out with under complete tension, and then up to here, which is like already around 10,000 cells, it's still almost completely under tension, and then it actually pressure starts winning, and at some size, it'll always go over into this state where pressure is dominant, just because linear expansion of the colony can never keep up with exponential cell division. And also, I mean, also as Jens said in his talk, there's a coupling between between pressure and cell division in the model, because this each cell is two spheres, and only if they manage to separate and reach a certain size checkpoint will they actually divide. So if there's a lot of compression, they will not divide. But nevertheless, most of the places here, it's actually under tension. And it's actually the viscous forces, the viscous dissipation in the tissue that are actually balancing this tension. So and to get back to this point, what does the tissue actually gain by having this type of alignment, right? Here is the parameter, the relation between these two parameters varied, right? So actually one just means no coupling whatsoever, and then numbers bigger than one means that there is some positive coupling, and this is actually coupling in the wrong direction. You see, this is coupling between velocity and cell motility orientation, right? So I said, like in this model, right, the ratio of this k plus and k minus is the degree of coupling. So one just means it's completely random where the cell puts its orientation. Larger than one means that the aligned state is kind of 10 times more stable than the opposite alignment. And so we plot the covered area, the square root of the covered area, and since it's going to be expanding linearly in the radius, you just get a kind of a line. And so the slope of this line is just the expansion speed, and if this expansion speed due to motility is bigger than the expansion speed due to pressure, then you actually have some benefit. And you just do the back of the envelope calculation, just saying that so you have continuity equation with cell division coupled to pressure. You have the force balance condition where you say that actually dissipation with the substrate is the dominant mode of dissipation. And then you can go into the paper, okay, so you can solve it. You get the velocity of a very large colony is just going to scale like this. So it's the pressure times the maximum division rate, so k times p0, over the friction with the substrate. And then when you go and you plug it into the numbers you can get out of CREPA, I'll of course just by some scaling arguments, just trying to do some estimates, you get that the pressure-based spreading speed would be around 2 micron per hour, whereas the motility speed that you know is about 10 micron per hour. So unless the expansion pressure, the growth pressure of the tissue is on the order of 10,000 Pascal, you're actually going to gain something by having this motility coupling mechanism and using this coordinated cell motility. So now back to the simulation. So the other phenomenon I introduced in the beginning was these swirls in the bulk of the tissue. So what we did here is we just use a compartment with periodic boundary conditions. And we grow the tissue, we seed it kind of at almost confluent density. So the blue spots here are just holes in the density. So the color code, indicates cell density, and the vectors are the cell velocity field. And we can now watch that indeed our model can reproduce these type of swirl patterns. And we watch it as the tissue fills up the compartment and density goes up. And you see that the length scale of the swirls also goes up a lot. And it kind of makes this transition to like a universal treadmilling state at high density. So so we can, yeah. So basically the same kind of model is, and this is even the same parameters that we used in the big spreading colony simulation.
The model for fingerprint.
Finger, that's... I don't know about anything about that, yeah. But basically these things, it's a transient effect. The cells, once they're confluent for a while, they really settle down and become the most well-behaved things ever, right? And they're, so essentially after a few days at confluence, I would say they're a completely different animal than in this initial state. And so the last thing, this is kind of preliminary result, right? So is that we just take a tissue and we just initialize it with hard walls here and periodic boundary conditions here. And we just remove the wall and then see what happens when we let the wall go. And so we get this kind of instability type thing happening. And of course, there's still some problems, so we're working on this right now. Because one problem is that the initialization is just in a treadmilling state because it's such a long, narrow compartment with periodic boundary conditions. So now the whole thing gets dragged a bit in this direction, which is kind of ugly. And so we're working on improving this simulation. But basically, it's just to convince you that to get some fingers at the edge, right, this model is actually sufficient. And since I talked about all this flocking stuff, and I want to make a connection with fingers, I just want to quickly show that in these simple flocking models, you do get this kind of fingering instability at the edge, and quickly go through this calculation. So we now we assume continuity equation incompressible, no cell division at all. So everything just comes from motility. And then we, in the force balance condition, we assume a viscous fluid with a viscosity at eta, and then we put these spontaneous motility terms. So this is the same terms that people put in flocking theory, a term m times v, which is the spontaneous motility force, the motility force aligned in the direction of the velocity, and then a higher order friction term to stabilize the system. And so we treat, just for simplicity, a semi-infinite tissue homogeneous in y direction, and you can solve it, and there's two unperturbed solutions for a flat interface. One of them is just the non-moving solution, and the other one is the solution where it goes to its spontaneous velocity. But this solution, where it's at spontaneous velocity, is actually going to be stable, and in addition, all the experiments about fingering are done, you know, by removing an agarose block or laser ablating something, so probably also we're more interested in this kind of solution. Just starting from a non-moving tissue. So we just do a standard perturbation, so a standard stability analysis by imposing this type of perturbation on the surface, and the boundary conditions are that the stress tensor has to be balanced by the line tension at the edge, the diagonal component of the stress tensor has to vanish, and then, of course, the motion of the edge is just the velocity of cells at the substrate. And you can solve it, and you get a dispersion relation like this. And essentially, this dispersion relation just looks like... So here's Q and omega, and then you have a Q1. And it does this. So essentially, what you know is that between Q0 equals 0 and Q1, you have an instability occurring. So, and we can now again just try to plug in some numbers and see which range of wave numbers we expect, right? So, just going back and actually using the same parameter estimate for the motility or friction that we used before. which is about 1 pascal times an hour over a micron squared, and then going to the literature and getting a typical value for tissue viscosity. So this is for 3D tissues, so it's like 10 to the 4 pascal. Perhaps for a real, for 2D tissue, maybe it's 2 orders of magnitude lower than this, but that's just going to shift it more in the right direction. And so it's kind of a conservative estimate, and you get a Q1 of about 10 to the 6 per meter, meaning that essentially over the entire ranges that matter biologically, like from infinite wavelength to size of a single cell, you should have an instability, and you expect kind of a wide range of modes, but perhaps with especially pronounced at the smaller wavelengths. Of course, there's a cutoff at a single cell size, right, where you can't really make a finger smaller than that. And so, just to show that maybe this has some relevance, right? Just to make the connection with these flocking theory model. So here's some kind of deer, and they make some kind of finger here. And then you have I like this one even better. This is like wildebeest in the Serengeti. And here you have these large scale patterns. And here even there's this another one coming out. And perhaps this one is a leader beast here. And so essentially, I'm going to sum up with some questions that are there, right? So, first of all, for me, the most interesting, is there any experimental evidence for this proposed mechanism? So actually, in San Diego, there's a person that we're collaborating with. He can actually put a microfluidic channel on top of cells. And then we can control the flow through the channel. So the hope is by that we can exert a force on the cells and maybe test this hypothesis that if we push them in one direction, they want to go in the same direction. So far they've used this for endothelial cells, where they're a bit different, but there the result is much clearer than for epithelial cells. They will just go against the flow no matter what because it has an influence on the location of the nucleus. So then the second question is, what's the relative importance of leader cells, at the tissue edge? Because obviously there is contact inhibition, and the cells at the edge of at the tip of a finger really have almost no neighbors. So it makes sense also biologically that they have a different morphology and they're more active. And in the data by Tripa, you saw that the traction forces at the edge are much higher than the traction forces in the center. So the boundary does play a role. And so the role of contact inhibition would be interesting for me, and just to know how much comes from the bulk, how much comes from the edge, from the tip. So, and then the relative importance of tension and contact for cell proliferation and contact inhibition, right? So and here I would strongly go in the direction of saying that probably contact is more important for contact inhibition after all, since in the bulk of this tissue, the cells are falling asleep even though they're under very high tension. But this kind of questions we cannot really address in our model, although we could put the effect in if we wanted to. And then finally, the influence of initial conditions on the spreading, right? I think it's important to keep in mind that if you start the whole experiment by removing an agarose block and the cells have been sitting there for a long time, it may be completely different than from having this colony growing for a long time scale, because the cells have just completely fallen asleep in the first case. Okay, thank you. That was my talk.
I have a question about this motility force. So if I have a single cell that's freely working on a substrate, I think that the total traction force is zero, just because it's...
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And then in that case, how do you use a model, because it's always zero, but there's a quantum velocity all the time?
Well, I mean, for that cell, it's kind of in the most comfortable situation because it's just moving, and it's always in the direction, the velocity is always pointing in the same direction as the motility force, right? So total traction force is zero, but the cell will still just do the same thing. There's going to be some rate at which it switches its orientation, and you're going to have a random walk. And that random walk may not be very long, right? Because it just depends on what the rate is. Nevertheless, if you take a collection of these cells, maybe you will get a much more persistent random walk. So another way to look at it is you saw that in the spreading colony, actually. The tension was building up at the edge of the tissue, not in the center, right? And the reason is just because essentially all the cells at the edge are moving with their maximum velocity just by having their orientation pointing outward. But then at the same time, they still can divide. So you're going to have actually pressure building up at the edge. And tension still being present to the last point in the center in this kind of model. Yeah.
In that sense, it seems like there's no difference between epithelial cells and mesenchymal type cells.
That's the big simplification we made, right? We assume that just all the cells are the same, right? We don't say that there is contact inhibition and they're falling asleep in the center and are more active at the edge. So there's a big simplification, and I agree that it's there, right? We could put it in, but probably if I had put it in, you guys would believe me less. Because, yeah. But so one way to think about it is just to say that one question that we've been asking ourselves is what actually breaks the symmetry of why, you know, what makes outwardly oriented better than, you know, just making, why doesn't the whole thing flip around and suddenly a group of cells just goes compressile and just moves in that direction? But of course, you know, it's because there's a tendency of cells to expand, right? So even though the entire tissue is under tension, the expansion pressure still breaks the symmetry. So even like you just say that the KD minus KA, so the effective division rate as a function of pressure is like this, and now if all the cells were, imagine it's a one-dimensional system, and all the cells are pulling on the system, then you're here. So you're gonna a tensile stress will create a lot of cell division. On the other hand, if all of them just flip around the other way and you create a compression, you're probably going to be at a much smaller division rate. So the main point is that just going outward is always better. It's kind of like a ratchet, right? Cells are always being stretched and the viscous dissipation is taking the stress, but then when they reach a certain size, another one is inserted. And going the other way isn't simple, because then you're compressing them, and you very quickly stop just due to compressive forces and due to just expansion pressure of the cells. Okay.
This is presumably a model for wound healing. Right? In some sense.
Yeah, that's right.
Wound healing has this other feature that you get blood flow easily, and because of excess oxygen, you usually kind of have a scab that forms. And that becomes a substrate along which the cells can grow and
live.
So is it possible for you, I don't know if it's possible, for you to make some kind of image or movie of an actual wound?
It's a pretty good one on Wikipedia, actually.
and does it grow like this? I would imagine it would be kind of uniformly across the substrate, because it would be guided by cadherins, right? It would be by active signaling on the substrate by the scab.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is obviously just a... Even epithelialization is only one phase in wound healing, which is a very complicated process, and all kinds of like inflammation phase, and then laying down this new substrate that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And then I actually have to admit I don't know enough about what actually re-epithelialization looks like, right? What I read, it should look like these experiments, right? That the cell really moves as a sheet, and it's not individual cells detaching.
Another way to ask the question is, what is the time scale over which, say, a wound of a certain size in your experiment would heal? Because wound healing actually is a very slow process. It takes a long time.
So again, we're only looking at re-epithelialization, right? So, but basically the time scale would just be this maximum velocity, 10 micron per hour, and then times the size of the wound, right? If there's nothing blocking it, right? But of course, there's all kinds of things, right? It's degrading some stuff that's in the way. And
also, your cells don't die. In real wound, you think the edge cells probably die.
Putting apoptosis rate is very easy in the model. And the reason we didn't is just that in these experiments, they observe almost no cell death. But I think the cells you're talking about that are dying are more the cells that have done the initial work of laying down the matrix and so on. Once the epithelium moves in, right, it's spreading and it doesn't have an interest in dying, right?
That's true.
Remember, I asked that question Boris about in his talk, and he said the apoptosis rate was at least two orders of magnitude smaller than the division rate. And that's exactly the reason why I asked him, because nobody says anything about apoptosis. They just say it's a small, and it's hard to get a number.
Yeah, but yeah, we can put it in. I don't think it will change much. Okay.
Yeah. Within this layer of cells, it would start like a tumor cell, activating oncogene or something, light exposure or something.
Yeah.
Would that be different where you start, like within the swallow or the fingers or whatever?
In the normal tissue, it's more, I would say, it's like a single cell that's in this mature tissue, right, where all the cells are making these, have already made these contacts. But a cancer cell, I mean, looks a lot like these non-contact inhibited cells, right?
Right.
It's like a cell that does all this moving around, all this motility business, although it's completely in confluent tissue. So that'll just, you know, kind of create some holes and kind of create some.
Not talking about the entire cancer cell, but if you have a normal cell, then within the cell, if you start with one.
But see, the whole process is only about wound healing, right? In a normal tissue, the epithelium is already confluent, and I don't know whether there's some connection between, can you get cancer while you have a wound or something like that? I just don't know enough about it.
No, I'm just thinking about an experiment where you would actually
Put one.
Activate an oncogene by like two photons.
I see, okay.
Within the swab, within the finger.
Maybe you can generate a finger by that, right? Maybe you just take a cell at the edge, you activate the oncogene, make it undergo this transition, and then if it's motile, maybe it'll pull a finger. That's actually nice, that you can demonstrate, you can create a leader cell and maybe stimulate a finger.
All right, then, thank you.